Welcome, this is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic magazine, dated 11/22. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the first article entitled The Desert Capital, A New Order by Robert Draper. With a mix of audacity and ambition, Egypt aims to relieve Cairo's crowding by transforming arid land into a gleaming capital city built for 6 million people. When I returned to Egypt in June for the first time in 15 years, I struggled to recognize it in Cairo alongside the Nile River, the first mile of a promenade called the Mamsha Ahim Mizir, Walkway of the Egyptian People, had just opened, affording sweeping views of the famed waterfront. The sprawling nearby neighborhood known as the Maspero Triangle was in the middle of a drastic facelift. Rundown sections had been razed, and pricey riverside condos will take their place, part of a plan to demolish 357 residential areas throughout Egypt's 27 governorates. Hundreds of houses on Warraq, a small island in the Nile, have been bulldozed to make way for hotels. The river's storied houseboats were being dismantled or towed off one by one. Departing the city on the Taha Masr Bridge, the world's widest cable-stayed span, opened in 2019, I traveled north through a welcoming green burst of farmland before reaching the desert around Alexandria. The roadways were so new the asphalt was sticky. The main exits to towns under construction on the coast were yet to be completed. A posh beach resort to the west of Alexandria, New El Alamein, rose from the shore of the Mediterranean just 4 years ago. With a projected price tag of $60 billion, it will eventually include three universities and a presidential palace. An upscale area called the Latin Quarter was offering four-bedroom seaside chalets for as little as $250,000. Returning to Cairo, I headed east to a satellite city, New Cairo, replete with shiny office towers and plush restaurants, most of which had sprung up since my previous visit from what had been the emptiness of the eastern desert. The city projected a sedate affluence, far more akin to suburban Dallas than to the clamorous pulse of historic Cairo. Another half hour farther east, along a not yet fully paved highway, the new administrative capital sprawled before me. Still lacking a permanent name, with only a fraction of its projected population of 6 million living there, the city, being built nonetheless, lies at the heart of Egypt's ambitious modernization plans. In a year's time, perhaps less, what also had been nothing but desert will shimmer with thousands of new residents. The spectacle will seem discordant with the everyday chaos that is Cairo. Here, everything will be orderly and polished and gigantic. The tallest office building in Africa, the continent's biggest mosque and biggest cathedral, a public gathering area twice as long as New York City's Central Park. There will be plenty of diversions too. Museums, restaurants, and shopping malls, a sumptuously marbled opera house, and a library collection of more than 5 million books. Visiting Cairo and the beach resorts from here will seem effortless thanks to a new high-speed rail system. In this Oz-like urban miracle, one rather idiosyncratic building, already finished, stands out, Egypt's capital's museum. As the name suggests, the museum celebrates cities that have been the seat of government during the country's 5,000 years of recorded history. For simplicity's sake, the exhibits focus on the six most consequential capitals. The first, Memphis, just south of Cairo; Thebes, the ancient dominion of the pharaohs; Tell el Amarna, Egypt's birthplace of monotheism; Alexandria, namesake of Alexander the Great; Cairo, under Islamic influence; and the modern era's urban Cairo, under Ottoman and British rule until independence in 1922. Implicit in this narrative of Egyptian history is the argument that relocating one's capital constitutes a momentous, but also somewhat customary, turn of events. Indeed, Egypt hardly stands alone in having done so recently. In 1960, the Brazilian government relocated from Rio de Janeiro on the southeastern coast to a more central site in the Savannah heartland, creating Brasilia from scratch in 41 months. 4 decades later, to relieve congested Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia moved its administrative and judicial offices 24 miles south to Putrajaya. In 2019, the president of Indonesia declared his intention to create a new capital on Borneo to relieve the population pressures in Jakarta, which is slowly sinking because its wells pump out too much groundwater. Each of these countries used the relocation as an opportunity to create a modern urban showcase for the world to admire. As to why Egypt has elected to do so, the capital's museum offers a clue. In addition to hulking marble likenesses of historic Egyptian rulers displayed prominently on the first floor, a life-size bronze statue of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi stands in solitude on the second floor. The statue is easy to miss in that it doesn't loom from a great pedestal and is away from the pedestrian flow. Still, its presence is an indication that Egypt's authoritarian leader has tied his legacy to the founding of a new capital. Also telling is how el-Sisi is depicted facing outward toward his creation, attentively presiding over how contemporary Egypt will be shaped and how its story will be told. El-Sisi's audacious plan, one that he inaugurated in 2015 without first addressing the public, much less putting the matter to a referendum, to relocate the seat of government, embassies, and the entire financial district out into the desert some 30 miles east of Cairo, has been set in motion. About a tenth of the government workforce already resides in the new administrative capital. The president may move to the new presidential palace there at the end of next year. This government-induced mass migration is part of el-Sisi's greater remaking of Egypt, which involves relocating millions of citizens to newly constructed cities and developing an elaborate transportation network that will connect residents from Cairo to agricultural districts in the Nile Delta and all the way to the Mediterranean coast, 150 miles away. In one sense, el-Sisi's decision to move the capital from Cairo, the seat of government for more than 1,000 years, was born of the sober recognition that the city is a ticking time bomb, unable to accommodate its 20 million inhabitants, much less the 4 million who commute in and out daily. Our number one goal was to relieve the overcrowding and the traffic, Ahmed Zaki Abdin, who was overseeing the development at the time of my visit, told me as we sat in his office, situated among the government ministries in the new capital. Egypt's population is growing by 2 million every year. Construction and expansion all over the country is essential. But with a smile, Abdin also reminded me, we are the builders from ancient times, 5,000 years, basic to the identity of Egypt's 106 million people, as its new capital reminds us, is civilization building, not just once, but many times over. The apparition I beheld when I arrived in the new capital was more supersized construction zone than functioning city, requiring some exertion of the imagination. The St. Regis Al-Masa, where I stayed, is still the only hotel. Connected to it by a long pedestrian skyway is the city of arts and culture, a stupefying and mostly completed 127-acre array of manicured gardens, grand performance halls, art galleries, and artist studios. Otherwise, the eerie silence in the desert city, broken intermittently by the growling of construction machinery, underscored the project's degree of difficulty. Just a few freshly planted trees stood in the arid vastness that eventually will be the Central Park. Its boutiques had yet to open. The elevated guideways for the monorail lurched over the dusty streets like concrete skeletons. The shells of handsome residential communities with international-sounding names such as El Patio Oro, La Verde, and Celia stood vacant in rows. The 77-story ebony iconic tower was without tenants or, for that matter, appliances and finished walls. Taking the construction crew's creaky elevator to the 52nd floor, I had a clear vantage of the new capital's planned districts for businesses, for diplomats, for parliament, for the government's ministries, and for the president. Somehow, by the end of the decade, this view would also encompass millions of residents. For now, the capital dwellers consist principally of construction workers, thousands of whom are Chinese, since China's state-owned construction firm is the contractor for the iconic tower. The Egyptians have unsurpassed experience when it comes to building monumental capitals, but this time around they have chosen to solicit assistance. A French company will manage the electrical network, while a German one will operate the water and sewage systems. "We're using all kinds of foreign expertise without any shame," Abdin said. The project, though, has suffered some setbacks. Not long after we spoke, Abdin resigned, ostensibly for health reasons, but amid reports of costly flaws in some of the buildings. The government has revealed few details about the construction, including where all the money is coming from for this building boom, except to insist that it won't cost Egyptian taxpayers anything. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have invested significantly, and indeed the city's main thoroughfare is named Mohammed bin Zayed Road, after the UAE's president. For that matter, the gleaming postmodern cityscape of the new administrative capital will seem aesthetically familiar to anyone who has visited Dubai. Still, the city's designers have taken some pains to reflect Egyptian history. At the entrance of the City of Arts and Culture, an obelisk from the reign of Ramses II has been moved from the earlier capital city of Tanis to this one in newly restored condition. It's impressive, but pint-sized in comparison with the soon-to-be-constructed Obelisco Capitale. At 1 kilometer in height, it will be the tallest tower in the world. In the lobby of the drama hall, large images of pharaohs playing the senet, a precursor to chess, and enjoying musical performances, remind visitors that familiar aspects of contemporary culture took root here. And when I peeked into the 1,200-seat concert hall to view its organ, the largest in the Middle East, of course, I was informed by my tour guide that the pipe organ was invented in Alexandria. My guide for the City of Arts and Culture happened to be its senior engineer, Ahmed El Dali. Having overseen its construction since shortly after excavation began in January 2018, El Dali considered it a point of pride that the outside world knew next to nothing about the building crew's prodigious labors. 13,000 workers, all of them with phones, yet no photos, he said with relish. "We have a saying, work in silence and let the success do the talking." Of course, the other reason to work in silence in the new capital is that its entire construction is taking place under the supervision of the Ministry of Defense. There are security implications to any development project that involves the seat of government, but it can be fairly said that the administration of El-Sisi, Egypt's former Minister of Defense, who took power in 2013 by means of a coup, seeks to maintain a firm grip on how the country is portrayed. The president's press officials energetically sought to control how this story would depict Egypt. "I was not permitted to wander the new city unescorted." That same heavy hand also has sought to project an image of enlightenment and tolerance, decreeing, for example, that the new capital's El Fatah El Alim mega mosque open on January 6, 2019, the same day the city's 9,200-capacity Cathedral of the Nativity was inaugurated. Egypt's new smart city will emphasize green energy and cashless payment systems, and it will be a resolutely crime-free one, with a government protected from protests like those in 2011 that toppled Hosni Mubarak's regime, courtesy of a citywide surveillance system designed by the U.S. firm Honeywell. Most of all, the new administrative capital will be full of life, if not necessarily by choice. A huge number of Kyrenes will have their lives upended. My cousin is a nurse who was forced to go work at its new hospital, a 56-year-old woman who identified herself by her Arabic name, Abdu, told me. It's a very hard commute for her. We were sitting in her fast food shop in the Boulouk district of Old Cairo, a bustling hub of secondhand clothing stands and makeshift auto repair shops. Within the next few years, Boulouk will be demolished and most of its inhabitants relocated to new, fully furnished, free housing units in the El Azmarat projects several miles away. Already, Abdu's shop has been chased out of one swiftly razed neighborhood. although the government had compensated her. "The new places look quite nice," she said, "but take a look around. We're in the heart of the city. Everything I could want is here." To Abdu and other natives of Cairo, the thousand-year-old city was anything but disordered. Its pedestrian maelstrom and cluttered streets were thoroughly comprehensible, the result of an organic agglomeration that had outlived a succession of autocrats and was therefore a thriving governing force of its own. It was not Riyadh. Cairo's character was both welcoming and confounding, a spirited tempest of humanity, an irreplaceable feat of architecture. A visitor like me could not help but be awed by it. Abdu considered the new look of her country. "I can't believe this is Egypt," she said. "It seems more like Europe." Deeper into the neighborhood, I encountered two middle-aged sisters, Magda and Fatem, who tended a tiny grocery store where residents dropped by throughout the day to grab whatever they needed and returned at midnight to pay their bills in cash. Suspicious of the media in a country that does not exactly embrace the virtues of a free press, they declined to tell me their last name, but Fatem poured me some tea, and they described with chagrin how Bulak has changed. "Slums are all behind this building," Magda said. "They're built out into the alleys so that you can reach out your window and shake your neighbor's hand. There are drug dealers and pickpockets with knives. Dirty, dirty." Despite having lived in the neighborhood all their lives, the sisters viewed its imminent destruction as a blessing. "It has to be done," Fatem said. "Just like the new capital, it will clear out the traffic. Life will be so much easier." But, I asked, would all this newness rob Egypt of its allure? "Never," said Fatem, as her sister nodded. "Here is the origin. Here is the history. It will always be here." The next article, Plant-Based Meat, Making the Grade, by Mark Wilson. "Nuggets, burgers, bratwurst made of plants, I've tasted them all and become a fan, but there's still that meat mystique. The portobellos strike my Le Creuset pan with a sizzle, leeks, onions, and carrots going next, along with a full bottle of California Cabernet. After hours of braising, I reduce the burgundy slurry to syrup, which I spooned over the mushrooms again and again until they're glazed with an ube donut, like an ube donut. Because Chef Thomas Keller's braised short ribs was my favorite meat dish, I felt confident adapting the recipe with portobellos for my first vegan Thanksgiving, but as I placed the mushrooms onto the plates of my guests, some of my closest relatives, I already sensed that I'd made a mistake. The portobellos had turned the unappealing color of organ meat. As I sliced in, they didn't taste bad. They simply tasted like portobellos. Every single portobello I've ever eaten, off every single vegetarian menu anywhere. To this day, I remember it as the Thanksgiving when no one talked. It was never my mission to exalt vegetables. I was a nose-to-tail carnivore until a high cholesterol diagnosis led me to embrace a plant-dominant diet. And I certainly couldn't have imagined on that Thanksgiving that a decade later I'd be one of the nation's principal journalists covering the new wave of plant-based proteins. Impossible, incredible, awesome, sensational, beyond. Meat alternatives branded with these and other superlatives now constitute a multi-billion dollar market that could be nearly 20 times larger by 2030. And yet, my singular question about each new product is always the same. Well, what does that taste like? Does it taste like meat? Quite often it does. These new foods are engineered to mimic meat, designed to match its distinct chewiness, bloodiness, and umami flavor. Nowhere is this achievement clearer than at Beyond Meat's laboratory in Los Angeles. There, the company puts beef and chicken samples under a microscope to understand how their proteins and fats are woven together. Then it uses all the modern marvels of industrial production, including heating, cooling, and the same extrusion process used to make Cheetos, to alchemize animal doppelgangers out of pea protein, coconut oil, and other non-meat ingredients. Meat is sometimes special to Americans in that it's absolutely mundane. We in the United States now eat more meat than ever before, a total of 264 pounds of beef, veal, pork, and chicken per person per year. And though we've curbed our love for beef over the past 40 years, we've more than made up those pounds in chicken. 8 years ago, to avoid going on medication to correct my high cholesterol, I switched to a diet that's 85% plants and plant-based foods. So far, it's working. Only as I consumed less meat did I begin to see the meat all around me driving this market by char-grilling its way across every avenue of advertising into my consciousness. A single hamburger is, by all measures, an unsustainable product requiring 660 gallons of water to produce, including lettuce, tomato, and a bun. And yet, we've come to expect this subsidized luxury, the result of tens of billions of dollars in annual U.S. reimbursements to the meat and dairy industries over the past decade, versus a fraction of that subsidizing fruits and vegetables. None of meat's true cost, ethical, environmental, or nutritional, really matters to most people, an Arby's restaurant executive told me in 2019. He also vowed that his company would never sell plant meat because, as he declared, people are not going to pay more for something that tastes worse. Years before that conversation, when I first adopted what I call my mostly vegan diet, I hunted down the finest plant-based meats that America's chefs had to offer. I sampled jackfruit carnitas on home-pressed masa tortillas at Gracias Madre in San Francisco, a beet-dyed seitan Reuben at the Chicago Diner, and the namesake sandwich at Superiority Burger, a mixture of quinoa, chickpeas, walnuts, and veggies, in New York City. All were just as delicious and functionally not replicable in my daily life as Thomas Keller's short ribs, and still they weren't quite meat. So I turned to the machines of industrialization, which over the past decade have been churning out a Cambrian explosion of plant-based alternatives made for meat-loving Americans. When companies have new products they want me to try, they overnight them to me with dry ice. The resulting skyscraper of plastic foam coolers in my garage is the worst skeleton in my closet. I've tasted dozens of plant meat items, burgers, bratwursts, bacon, chorizos, taco meat, Italian sausages, breakfast sausages, meatballs, chicken fingers, chicken nuggets, beef jerky. Now that I've eaten just about every major product on the market, I appreciate each for its distinctive sensations. I find myself wishing I could mix and match their traits to create a super meat of sorts, one plant meat to rule them all. I'm fascinated by the way that daring chicken chunks char up in a pan just like a leg of chicken on the grill, and the way an impossible burger bleeds heme, a meaty-tasting foam form of iron that's produced here with soy protein instead of animal protein. I find it remarkable how Kentucky Fried Chicken's Beyond Fried Chicken chunks shred with the same stringiness as ever so overcooked white meat, which is perfectly imperfect at recreating the sensation of KFC's. My biggest shock recently was a chicken breast made with mycelium, the subterranean heart of a mushroom. It looked like a giant breaded guitar pick, but flavor-wise was so indistinguishable from breaded baked chicken that I wondered, from a practical standpoint, why we still bother raising chickens, or portobellos for that matter. Yet no company is good at making everything. When I tried the same vendor's steak made from the same mycelium, it had the texture of an aged fillet, but the odor of a Subway pole. I watched the plant-based meat industry like I watched the Chicago Bears, with marvel, skepticism, and, frequently, disappointment. But truth be told, much of the world solved its meat addiction millennia ago, examined cuisines across the world, and you'll see that cultures have evolved to harvest protein without meat. I am not simply referring to the original plant meats, tofu, commonly thought to have been invented during the Han Dynasty, circa 150 BC, or seitan, thought to have been developed in the area even earlier. In Mexico, corn tortillas and beans marry the essential amino acids to create a complete protein. Across South America, it's beans and rice. In Ethiopia, it's lentils and the ancient grain teff. And in India, ground rice and black gram, a relative of the mung bean, ferment together into a batter used to make steamed idli cakes and crisp dosas. It's difficult to imagine the human sacrifices that brought our cultures this incredible knowledge. How many poisonous things did we eat before we learned that rice was worth cultivating? How many generations were malnourished until a tribe realized that one family, stronger and healthier than the rest, always ate certain plants in combination? The first amino acid wasn't discovered until 1806, from asparagus, by the way. The last wasn't discovered for another 120 or 130 years. By the time scientists found the 20 amino acids inside a complete protein, cultures had been reverse engineering them into their diets for thousands of years. Through this historical lens, I will admit that I begin to see plant meat differently. And for that, it really is. Consider that when we talk of the pea protein inside any popular plant burger, it's not made from garden-fresh green peas, but from an ingredient many Americans ignore in the grocery's ethnic foods aisle, the split yellow peas cooked into popular Indian dals. Here, the cutting-edge combination of pea protein and rice in a plant-based burger is not particularly novel or unique. Rather, it is what the West does best. We have reconstituted tradition into a logo. Repackaging these staple proteins as meat is more than a hot business trend. It is the colonization of the global diet. We're Americanizing and corporatizing the very components behind historical meatless world cuisines that have successfully and satisfyingly fed countless generations. And yet, standing in my backyard with a bottle of light beer in my hand and an Impossible Burger on the grill, I feel a certain satisfaction. I am reaching my own manifest destiny as a suburban American man, all while dodging the guilt of greenhouse gases, animal cruelty, and the damage I'm doing to my own heart. This bleeding patty is desire. This bleeding patty is patriotism. This bleeding patty is brand. It is meat. The United States leads the world in meat consumption per capita, with an intake three times as high as the world average. But in the U.S. and other high-income nations, demand is expected to level off as populations age and add more diverse protein sources to their diets. The shift to poultry over the past three decades has been driven by the perception that white meat is a better food choice and more convenient to prepare. Octomothers. Octopuses fascinate us with their dexterity and keen intelligence, their capacity for problem-solving and play. Most coastal octopus species live for about a year. The largest and longest-lived, the giant Pacific octopus, may live up to 5 years. Most octopuses reproduce just once late in life, and at this time they enter senescence, a months-long period of decline marked by diminished feeding and coordination, tissue breakdown, and even self-cannibalization. This concludes readings from National Geographic Magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening and have a great day.